And welcome to Trippy Politics, Protests, and
Potpourri.
I'm your host, Corey Elliott, and as always, my co-host,
Leslie McLam.
Okay, and welcome, folks, to Trippy. Okay, so real quick, I'm going to let you introduce yourself, give us a little background on yourself. There's been this situation going on here in Portland about Live Nation trying to come in and trying to basically, like, take over a lot of these different music venues or whatever, and, like, I'm just barely even understanding this, but you kind of, you're in the center of it, you're kind of looking at everything, so give us your name, what your background is.
Totally. So, my name's Jesse Valencia, really excited to be here. I'm a member of Music Portland's Music Policy Council, which has been at the forefront of the Live Nation fight. For a little bit about me, I'm from Arizona. I grew up there. I moved here about a year ago, a little over a year ago. My mom lives in Newport. My sister lives in Corvallis. So I've got family here. And I've got a lot of friends here. My friend Zia McCabe and the Dandy Warhols invited me to a music policy forum in December of last year with Jesse Cornett, who's running for City Council in District 3, and Jamie Dunphy, who's running for City Council in District 1.
Okay.
And so, at the time, that was the first that I really had heard about the Live Nation issue. And then there in December, I signed up immediately for Music Portland, offered my help and that I wanted to get involved. And that's what I did. And what I brought to the table, based on my experience in Arizona, was I've been a musician for 20, 25 years in the indie underground scenes. My band is called Gorky, G-O-R-K-Y, and we're kind of an indie rock garage band. Beyond that, I've been really involved in the film industry. I've worked in movie theaters for 10, 15 years, and I've been in films. I've done score for films, and that led me to lobbying for the Arizona Media and Film Coalition. And in that process, I learned a lot about the governmental legislative process and how that works. And so I explained that to Music Portland and to Jamie Dunphy, who's the chair of Music Policy Council. That led to me volunteering with Music Policy Council. And then switching gears now to Live Nation, the issue with Live Nation in Portland is that Portland is the last city without a Live Nation venue.
We're a holdout amongst all the cities.
Right, a holdout amongst all the major cities. And why that's important is because what's happened here in Portland is very special with music and independent music. PSU did a study that came out in 2022, I believe, or it might have come out early 2023, that showed that Portland generates $3 billion a year just in independent music. So when we talk about that, the image that comes to a lot of people's minds is somebody in their bedroom or, you know, playing a show or
like grunge, like Nirvana before it got big, right?
Right, exactly, something like that. But what they don't realize or what we don't talk about is it includes venues, it includes record stores, that includes musicians, music entrepreneurs, music schools, music teachers, all of the people that support those things. So you're talking about adjacent businesses like bars.
Like trade up music here in Portland.
Exactly.
And the secondhand music shops.
Exactly.
I myself have worked as a stagehand. I myself have worked in merchandise. So like there's a whole bunch of different people that are involved with this. So yeah.
Absolutely. And PSU's study showed how all of that contributes to Portland's economy. And the numbers are staggering. We could say $3 billion. But that actually is as much money as is generated by tourism, and it's as much money as is generated by manufacturing, which is, you know, unions. So, and then when you look at just music, it employs more people than cannabis labor or cannabis, lumber, and salmon combined in the city. So, and considering that so much of that is just independent underground people working, doing everyday day-to-day things, it behooves us to come up with policies that can protect those things. So
So what you're saying, and you're bringing up the independent music industry against the Live Nation concept, is that there's typically a change or a shift in independent music when Live Nation comes into a major city and starts taking over and sort of navigating and structuring the music scene in the space. How does that happen? And like, can you give us an example of where and how?
I could totally give you an example of how it works. You'd want to look it up for specific things, but for a generic overall idea, if you look at cities like Austin, Nashville, Los Angeles, you know, Phoenix, what will happen is Live Nation will come in. They'll either acquire a venue that exists already or they'll build one. And then what they do, because Live Nation owns Ticketmaster. So, mm-hmm. And if you think of Live Nation as a management company, as an artist management company, who's also doing the tickets, what they'll do is they'll come into a town like Austin or Nashville and say, hey, we're gonna run all of your ticketing and promo venue. And then you just have to sign this contract with us that says you won't work with anybody else.
And no, yeah, they have a no-compete agreement.
Right.
So they can monopolize an area.
And I just realized, too, because this Ticketmaster being involved with Live Nation, this was the beef that Taylor Swift had with Ticketmaster mm-hmm. as well, is because of how much money was being pulled out of these different communities. And, like, mm-hmm. she was literally doing outreach, you know, into the communities when she was doing her tours and stuff. So, mm-hmm. yeah, no, this is huge.
This and is Bruce exactly what too. You're talking about. And Taylor Swift isn't the only one. Yeah. There have been a number of major, major artists across the performance spectrum, not just in music, but a lot of artists that are required to operate with Live Nation have had significant issues. They've actually gone onto social media and apologized to their fans for having no say or control in the pricing of the tickets. And I know one issue that I've heard a lot about is like surge pricing or something like
dynamic pricing.
Dynamic pricing.
Right. So these are all the business, like for a gamut of what the business practices are that Live Nation does that are so terrible. Dynamic pricing is a lot like airline pricing, right? Like when you go buy an airline ticket, at certain times of day, it'll be more expensive, right? Well, they applied that to their dynamic ticketing model. So you see things like it happened to Oasis over in the UK most recently, where sites were crashing because of this dynamic ticketing thing. And what happens with dynamic pricing and with monetization, what Live Nation calls market segmentation, mm-hmm. Really it's just monetization of anything from a hand towel to your parking space to create a tiered experience. So if you can afford it, you know, you'll be able to enjoy some, you know, enjoy a show like Taylor Swift.
It's like the company decides that each person needs to spend, say, $400, and they're going to find a way. So if you buy the cheap $100 ticket instead of the $250 ticket, then they're going to create a price experience package with all the parking, the different things that you are going to get on that experience, the basics. They're still going to do their best to price everything so that the total amount you spend is in the range that they want to extract a particular value and profit from it.
Another thing that's happening recently too locally is that Moda Center got purchased up by the city because it got sold by Moda. And so in the middle of all this, you also have Moda sitting there that's a prime for the city to sell off to Ticketmaster, to Live Nation as a new venue for them, and they can just, oh, wow.
Have okay. you heard anything well, about the Moda Center in your dealings with this?
Moda Center hasn't been something that's been brought up so much. What is important to keep in mind, though, is so monetization and dynamic pricing by itself, you know, you could say, hey, those things are bad. We don't want them in Portland. And they're bad by themselves. But those aren't the reasons why by themselves Live Nation is bad. The thing that needs to be kept in mind is that when somebody doesn't want something like this, Live Nation will intimidate and bully and get their way. And that's why they're the subject of a DOJ lawsuit right now in 40 states.
So yeah, speak more about that, because I don't know a lot about that, and I don't know how many listeners do.
Right.
Maybe they would like some more background. So what do you know about that DOJ lawsuit with Live Nation?
Well, so without getting into the weeds of it, because it's very it's a very big document, and it's free online, so anyone can find this. So if you go online and you search DOJ Complaint Live Nation, you'll be able to read it yourself because it's on the DOJ website, and okay. It's available for everyone. And something we'll talk about a little bit later, the Live Nation hearings that I testified at, almost all of us referenced this DOJ complaint when we were trying to stop this thing. So it's the DOJ filed an official lawsuit against Live Nation that 40 states, including Oregon, have now joined because they are highlighting these terrible business practices, which really amount to antitrust violations.
I was about to say, monopolization is a big issue when it comes to something at this level that controls an entire market and has no compete agreements in major cities over multiple tiers of an experience.
Right. And if you don't like their business model,
It. There's no alternative. You can't go to see a music venue. You can't go to the theater. There's a lot of different things that Live Nation will sell tickets for, up to small festivals even. They might have the deal for that. So they could run a lot of different venues you wouldn't know until they have everything in place. And then you find out, you know, who you're dealing with and you have no other option. What is it like for the customer experience with Live Nation? Like, how does that change through going to all these shows? And like, now you have to deal with Live Nation to get tickets. But if Live Nation is in charge, how is that different? How does that change?
It's constantly changing. Live Nation does operate in Portland already through ticketing with certain venues. Okay. So, which has been an issue in the sense that it becomes tricky because obviously, I mean, like at the end of the day, everyone's trying to make money, mm-hmm. right? We're all trying to, I mean, these venue owners, they have an overhead. They have employees to pay. They have insurance they got to pay. They got to keep people safe. So it's in their interest to make money. So if they're going to work with Live Nation, if Live Nation comes into the market, they see it as a market, that's what they're going to do. It's different to work with Live Nation as a ticketing company versus how they're going to operate when they have a base of operations that from which they can then spread out their model. What we're worried about on the Music Portland end, and especially the music community, is that once Live Nation builds their venue, they're going to have a lot more strength in terms of dictating how the local market's going to go. So that means say for instance, the Live Nation venue gets built, they're immediately going to have their eye on their next level competitors, which would be like Rev Hall, Crystal Ballroom, Roseland Theater, Aladdin, these kinds of places. And they're going to be moving in. So.
Right. And they would start with something like offering their online ticket sales service to current venues as an add-on to what they're already doing. And that's how they get their fingers in, right? They get their foot in the door.
Right.
And, you know, they say, hey, you need this because you might have people that are online only and won't carry cash or won't have what they need to buy a ticket in person.
Or the inverse.
Or right. And they've already got this app downloaded on their phone, right? So they try and sell it to the customer, something easy. They get involved in that. And then now that they have over 50% of the local venues having some sort of, you know, contract just for the online ticketing, they're already making that money and they have data that they've gathered about how the music and artist scene in Portland works.
Right.
Right. And they're going to use that data to actually figure out who to target,
right,
who to talk to, how to talk to them. They know these venues are good with this this demographic or this music spectrum. And they say, hey, this is a good profitable one. And these venues really make good money. They'll target those venues and shut them down.
Right.
And like you mentioned, the Crystal Ballroom. Mm-hmm. I've had some of the most amazing experiences at the Crystal Ballroom. I got to go see 2 Feet when they were here a couple years back. And it was wonderful to be in that venue, to have that local experience that didn't feel sanitized.
Right.
Like you do when it's a big, you know, like a multinational corporate.
Like going into a Walmart.
Right.
We call Live Nation the Walmart of music often because it's like going into a Walmart where you know what you're going to get. Everything's kind of nice and shiny, depending on which Walmart you're going into, right? And then
it all comes out of the same warehouse.
No
and everybody's
offense to
paid
Walmart,
minimum wage.
But
yeah, that's an interesting comparison because we don't have a lot of Walmarts here in Portland, and there was the one at the Oregon-Washington border that closed a while back, long time ago now.
And there's one at 82nd and Holgate, I believe, just shut down.
Yeah, there used to be two down 82nd Avenue, and one of them shut down. So now that was the one that closer in the city. So it's the one that was further south that's still open.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they are certain companies like that have traditionally
they move kind in, of been, they been shut pushed, down the mom and pops.
They shut down, but in Portland, what I've noticed is that they don't always last as long. And they, like Walmart, they got pushed out to the edges. And there's usually a big push among Portland residents to stand up for things like local businesses and local industries. And, you know, it sounds
And that's what we did.
With Music Portland, it sounds like that's what's happening, right? Can you tell us more about what is going on with Music Portland, what it is, what it does?
Yeah, so Music Portland is a trade association for musicians. And it's so we represent the interests of musicians and music businesses, music schools, music entrepreneurs in the city. Part of that, I mean, there's a wide range of functions that Music Portland does. One of the things is Portland Music Month is coming up in January, where we have these venues that we're working to protect, right, across Portland, have shows all month long where when people go to these shows, a portion of the ticket price goes to the Echo Fund, which is a grant program we have for musicians in the Portland metro area. That is, you know, I'm not exactly probably pitching that correctly 100%, but that does exist, and that's one of the things we do. Another thing we do is we host monthly get-togethers for the local industry people, local independent industry people to network and connect.
Where online, if someone is hearing about this for the first time, where would they go to connect for one of those events?
You would go to musicportland.org, or you would look us up on Instagram or Facebook at Music Portland. It's all one word. So Music Portland is one word. We have a bunch of events online. And one of the really exciting things we have right now is a map that we put together of the new districts with the election coming up. We have a map of the districts set up on the website under musicportland.org/elections, where you can click on your district and see the results of a candidate questionnaire that we put together about music policy for all of these different candidates that have engaged on it. So we're doing things like that as well.
The music policy questionnaire sounds interesting, very engaging. What did it take to put something like that together?
Well, really, honestly, it's just been being in the trenches of this Live Nation issue and, thinking of it as a pressure point, things come up. So you go, there's this Live Nation thing, we're trying to save venues. But then it's also like dynamic pricing comes in, and then we start talking about exclusionary contracts. Then we start talking about things like radius clauses where, you know, say an artist wants to come play in Portland, but they can't play two shows at two different venues because they have a radius clause that says you can't play within 20 miles of this venue until a couple such and such days have passed, right?
I have, personally, not being in the music scene, I've never heard of that. That is fascinating. That sounds like the no-compete thing I was talking about.
Right. It goes hand in hand. And then you also have like things like, just basic, you know,
so that's
living wages for musicians,
so that,
right?
That actually controls the livelihood of the artist. If you can't travel into Portland and, say, play one show a night over 3 days, you can't make a working weekend out of that visit. You're limited in how much you can earn.
Right. And
wow.
I mean, that's the thing about that's important about music policy. You were talking about markets earlier and Live Nation going into a market.
And how that affects things.
Right. Portland, with what's so there's an opportunity here, but it's also tragic is that despite being so huge with independent music, is that Portland seriously lacks in music policy. I mean, we're talking about things like the noise code, like there's a
noise ordinance is pretty common in
most
cities for general things like, you know, it can't be above a certain decibel volume after, say, 10 p.m.
Right.
or before 6 a.m. That's fairly standard, but can change from city to city. And I don't think I know what it is for Portland, what that decibel volume is.
Right.
Right.
Well,
is
that,
there a standard?
There's two different conflicting laws, actually.
Oh.
So there's what's called Title 18, which is the science based objective rubric, if you will, for a noise violation. But then they, the outgoing city council passed something called 14A30.10 and 14A30.20, which if you look in the Portland City Code, Chapter 14, it explains what it basically says is that if there's something that's noisy or loud and somebody doesn't like it, they can call and say, hey, it's loud. And all it takes is for a police officer to show up and be like, oh, yeah, I hear amplifiers. Guess I got to shut this down.
That's terrible. So it's basically if anybody feels annoyed at anything, there's no metric.
It's subjective. Yeah.
It's all. Yeah.
It's
that
all subjective.
Seems like going backwards.
Oh, it's totally backwards. But what the issue is that if you're coming from a police perspective, and I have a police background. I was a military police officer in the Army for 6 years, and my dad is a retired chief of police on the White Mountain from the White Mountain Apache Reservation back in Arizona. So seeing this from a police perspective, it's like a complete waste of resources to be calling people or to be calling the police on a house show where it's, you know, it's teenagers and 20-year-olds who are listening to music when those resources need to be going somewhere else. They're basically just calling to have them show up to stand there to listen. Oh, is it loud enough? Is it too loud? Okay, you got to shut it down. But there could be a viable business happening. You know, there could be something going on there.
And the response time, it could take 30 minutes for an officer to show up, maybe because they're in that town, in the area, but that's as soon as they could be there. And in that amount of time, the noise
right.
complaint could be ceased. It might be people realizing, oops, it's 10:25. I should probably turn that down.
Right. There's clear metrics for this.
So, yeah, there's no...
And they screwed it up by passing that 14A30. So one of the things that Music Portland wants to see is 14A30 completely gone. Just
so,
rescinded. We can fall back on Title 18 and from there build a sound, pun intended, a sound noise policy.
So how did the former city council even go about getting this 14A?
You know, I mean, that's one of the things that I can't speak to too much because I wasn't there because I just moved here a year ago. But my understanding is that, you know, there's a really strong developmental, you know, corporatist core in the city council as it exists right now. And that's obviously why we're changing to this new form of government so we can have more of a say in things across the city. I would just chalk it up to bad policy and people not knowing what they're doing. You know, they're not, if they were aware of the interests of that the city
like
was.
Portland City Council, does it? Sounds like Wheeler City Council, doesn't it, Corey?
Yep. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, like, imagine, it's as simple as imagine a Detroit without car policy or a Hollywood without filmmaking policy. Or, I mean, wouldn't that be weird? If you showed up to Hollywood and there was no laws on the books that
Florida
like,
without a golf club policy.
Exactly. So that's where music is right now in Portland. And it's imperative that we're all here. We're aware of it. So uniting on this issue is important and getting the awareness out because there's more at stake than just, you know, with Live Nation being built, the music scene and all this stuff. It's really about how we want to see Portland be rebuilt. Do we want to include what's great about it? Why would we get rid of what's great about it to fix what's wrong with it? So if what is great about Portland is its culture, its openness, its arts, its creativity, then let's use that to help things like homelessness, to help things like housing, incorporate those things. If that's a moneymaker, then we can't pretend like it's our, you know, a teenager in the room playing guitar, writing a song that they're going to show us later. We have to approach it like it's a viable economic model because it is.
We have to allow the space for people to be creative, to flourish, to explore, and to express. And I think Portland, Oregon is really well known for that, or Horace always has been.
Totally.
Might be the way to put it. But I know for me, for how long I've been a Portlandite and then going up to the Tacoma area to get my bachelor's degree and then, you know, still love Portland. I always keep coming back, right? KBOO is where my heart is. But it's different now. The tone has changed. And like you're saying, it's that developer corporate mindset that comes in. It's an attitude and an approach towards things. that they're doing. And it's very top down. It's very sterile. It's very my way or the highway, take it or leave it. Fast, easy, cheap, with the biggest return on the buck. It's less about creativity and expression. It needs to find value in function only, and function means profit. And there is no profit in a test run of creativity that might never see the light of day, because what you get out of it is intrinsic and feeds into the next project. And if you can't guarantee what that project is and how much you're going to get out of return value, then, you know, that top-down developer mindset doesn't want to move forward or take that risk. And they become very controlling in order to get that profit. And like you're saying, that would change Portland. That would change that incredible music industry that is independent and it grows on its own with that kid and on the guitar in his room.
Exactly.
Right? Like how... I'm not sure how to phrase my next question. While I think about it, Corey, you haven't
actually
had a chance. Why don't you jump in?
This right here, actually, going into this, you mentioned earlier to me about Prosper Portland involvement with all this, too.
Yeah, Prosper.
I've been kind of following a lot of what Prosper Portland's been doing over the last 10 years. There's been a lot of them kind of, you know, a lot of that organization pushing for what seems like economic development, but is being just basically gentrifying of the different parts of Portland. So, like, this, their involvement with this as well is very significant. Can you maybe speak to that a little bit?
Oh, yeah, I can speak a lot to it because I've been, and I can't speak to everything in it, but I've been researching it a lot. So, so Prosper Portland is what's been described as the development arm of the Portland City Council.
Yes.
It used to be called the Portland Development Commission.
Okay.
And it was founded, it was changed to Prosper in 2016 or 2017 to make it sound not like a development commission.
It's a buzzword situation, yeah, where they're going to use something that sounds aspirational but doesn't tell you anything. And I find it kind of trippy on its own that a development arm of the right would be considered Prosper, because they don't actually create prosperity for the actual residents in Portland.
Well, they do if you're friends with Prosper Portland. You'll get a kickback there. But so Prosper was, or we could call it Prosper, you know, PDC, whatever you want to call it. It technically, the name still is Portland Development Commission.
Okay.
But if you go back to the 50s, okay, so in the 50s, just for a quick history lesson, there was a lot of local native tribes that had their recognition, their federal recognition rescinded, right? Right after that, the Portland Development Commission was founded by a popular vote, I believe, ballot initiative. And how it works is the commissioners on that end were appointed by the mayor and confirmed by city council. So the mayor would put people in the Prosper board, and then they would decide how to develop the city. So, and then
it's been cronyism from the beginning.
Right. And then those decisions have to be approved by the city council. So a really good early example of this is the freeway that was created to take out Albina.
Okay.
You know, that is a perfect example of what Prosper was set up to do.
And destroyed North Portland's
yep.
black community.
That's not the only community.
And other
community.
Minority populations
right.
yeah.
that were living in that
and,
area.
And every time that we find out about the gentrification and
right.
that has done throughout history, it does actually tend to tie back to the Development Council.
Right, and there's a specific way. There's a specific way how things get gentrified, and I can explain this pretty easily. So
they have to economically depress an area to come in and swoop.
Well, yeah,
swoop in.
These factors like that. But basically, what happens is, like, just a real world example, because you guys have them around here. Pretty, you know, you've got Hollywood, or you've got Mississippi Avenue, or you've got Hawthorne District, or these kind of places that are business district, right? Or here in the Central East Side.
This area right around KBOO has gone through a lot of developmental. Used to be able to drive straight down the Burnside Bridge.
Absolutely.
We didn't have giant, tall skyscrapers. Now you can't see. You get no sunlight
on
Burnside half the time.
That's a perfect way to transition. Let's use the Central East Side Industrial District as our example. The Yard Building. There that's right at the end of Burnside. Is that's what you're talking about over
yeah.
here on this side, the Yard Building? Okay.
That's exactly it.
So going back to what you were saying about 10 years ago, You've been researching this for 10 years. So 15 years back is when Beam Development started to build the Yard building, right? And it was vastly unpopular or whatever. So Jonathan Mauzin is the CEO of Beam. And he is also the one who's building the Live Nation venue over here in the Central East Side Industrial District. So this is how this works. So the city, so Prosper, is where they get their power or what their development is to designate what's called TIF districts. So what TIF is tax increment financing. And this is a complicated thing that people are going to want to research themselves, tax increment financing. So what it does is Central East Side Industrial District, Prosper goes, that's going to be our new TIF district. So what we're going to do is we're going to take money from the entire city, from the taxpayers of the entire city, and we're going to invest it in just this district. And what we're going to do is this district has, you know, buildings need repair, it needs new roads, it needs new sidewalks. So we're going to get a developer like Beam to come in and we're going to build the Yard building. And then what's going to happen is because he's built that building with the help from us facilitating it, property values will rise in the Central East Side Industrial District. But here's where it here's where the gentrification comes in, okay? So say, for example, you have a house next to the Yard building, mm-hmm. right? And your property taxes were $5,000 a year. Mm-hmm. And you gave that to the city and it covered, you know, roads and health and police and emergency or whatever, right? So now the Yard building goes in and you've been designated as a TIF district.
Right.
So your income hasn't gone up, but your property value has.
Because of what somebody else did with their property in proximity.
Right, right. So now your property taxes are $7,000 a year, right? Because your home value has gone up. You have to pay more. Or maybe someone lives there, you have to pay more rent. What happens
there's
is...
There's a lot of things that will actually go up. It's not. It'll be the taxes. It might be
right.
the mortgage amount. It's going to be the cost of
something's
things at
go
the
up.
Nearby business. A lot of things will actually go up.
Yeah. And then, but what will happen is that 5,000 that went to the city before still stays the same. But what happens is the profit now that's been made off those property taxes, that 2,000 extra dollars mm-hmm. goes back to just that district.
So that one area gets richer and
that
richer.
That one area
richer
gets richer and richer.
It never has to share any of the profits that it is forcibly created.
Not to the rest of the city.
Yeah, to nobody else.
It no, to nobody else. So like
Laurelhurst, basically, keeps all the money. Sorry.
No, that's exact. If you guys look at Prosper Portland's website and you look at the TIF districts, those are the areas that are getting developed. And so what happens is, so now think of that, right? So Beam Development, Jonathan Mauzin of Beam. This is public knowledge. This is this, you can mm-hmm. you can Google this. He's been a member of Prosper's steering committees, and he has been a member of the Central East Side Industrial Council, which is like a business organization. And he leveraged that position to lobby the city council to remove a BIPOC homeless camp from the three lots in question where they're going to be building the Live Nation venue. He had you could look this up. Willamette Weekly reported on it. The BIPOC camp was removed to facilitate Prosper's development of the Live Nation venue. That's what it is. And after that is when Music Portland got involved. And people will say, oh, they removed, you know, over here or over there. But they moved him out of the district, out of the TIF district. That was all that needed to happen. So as a metaphor for what happens in this city on a bigger scale.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We're getting you see homeless camp sweeps. Right.
Yep.
Or we're sweeping them here. Well, where are we sweeping them to? We're sweeping them out of TIF districts.
Into the cheap zones.
Yeah. Into the cheap seats. Zones.
Yeah.
So that those places will get devalued and we'll go, oh, those are TIF districts.
And then
now.
People will run and flee because everything's
right.
going there and there's no services attached.
Right.
It economically depresses a zone one way or another.
That's why there's East Portland is the way it is right now.
It's been intentional. Yeah. And there
it's
was development over in East Portland a while back. Like, you remember how Powell got all redone, that section down there,
mm-hmm.
and some sections on Division got some development.
Right.
And that seems to have moved out. Oh, also, oh gosh, where is that? Not north of Mall 205, that whole area, like there used to be two lanes down the road and now there's weird curbs and lots of sidewalks. And it took them many years to develop a park. But everybody that had lived there that could afford that got wiped out of the area.
Yeah.
In order for them to put sidewalks in.
That's going
to
happen.
And now you can't drive down the road and you can only go like 15 miles an hour down a road that was designed to go 30.
Yeah.
And this is all ties into stuff that I've been trying to report on for quite some time. Like, literally, a lot of people try and say that the issues with Portland is the homeless, the drug addicted, the mentally ill. But those are societal afflictions people are suffering under greed, which is tied right into TIFs and all that.
Well, they're also coping mechanisms. They're just human coping mechanisms to turn to something to help them escape a reality that is dystopic and beyond out of their control when they've done everything they can and get punished for doing the right steps because it's still not enough.
And because they're existing in these districts, they're being pushed out and into other people's neighboring districts that haven't experienced it before. Because these people were encamped in areas that they weren't visible as much as they are. And so, yeah, this is why more and more people are starting to get upset with what's going on here in Portland, is because it's becoming more visible in front of them out of these districts where they historically were.
Well, you know how it is, and out of sight, out of mind, and broken windows policing. If you don't see it, it doesn't exist. But the minute it's in front of your house, it's the worst problem in the world.
Yes.
Well, and from my perspective, if I was somebody like Prosper, or if I was on the board of Prosper, if I was in the city council right now, like if I was up there with Renee Gonzalez and Mingus Maps and some of these other people, and I was looking at you know, what the situation was and how bad it was, it would be a very good problem to have to exploit, because if you think about it, it works in their favor to that this problem keeps going, because then they could say, hey, trust us, and we will take care of this problem, and they're going to sweep it out, make it look nice and shiny. Mm-hmm. All the people that voted for them will go down to a downtown where there's shops and things are clean, and you know, make no mistake, that's what they have in mind. It's a vision for Portland.
The goal to make profit in this case is to treat the symptoms, not the disease.
Yeah.
So if you cure your customer, you don't have a customer. If you alleviate temporarily the symptoms, which is push it out of view so you don't notice it, so you forget that how important or that it's everyday lives and humans, then people feel better. And the problem is still there for you to profit off of. And if it's a new zone, then you create a new company or brand name and handle it.
Totally.
And you're able to just keep the game going, basically, by pushing it into the next corner and getting there after you're done here.
Yeah.
And yeah.
This is something also that I'm seeing over in Old Town right now, too, is because there's something like $150 million redevelopment plan for Old Town from what I've been hearing. And they're trying to change up Old Town from what it historically has been, which was like a refuge for all the homeless and all the other people that are suffering. And that's because that's where all the services are. And you got like the Old Town Neighborhood Association that's basically at a conflict with some of those historical services, trying to push them out of the area. So yeah, all this ties in together because they're trying to make Old Town into a gentrified area for people to be able to come enjoy music more and stuff like that. But people can still do that right now.
Well, the TIF districts, the new TIF districts were announced the day after the Live Nation hearings. Okay. And then they were just approved, I think, this last week.
Okay.
So,
So what's the process for making a TIF district? That's you're saying that's made, that's all done by council members, right? Is there any input? Can community speak up or get involved? Like, how do, if say somebody wanted to make their area a TIF district because they want to keep it lively and get involved in that process, or if they don't want to be part of a TIF district, they want to see how that's happening. How does that work? Or is that all like a behind closed doors and we need to talk to our leaders to get the information, or make, you know, FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act requests?
Yeah, I think it's the latter, because I can't really speak to how TIF districts are decided. Where I would start first is Prosper's website, where this, I mean, connecting it back to why the Live Nation thing is such a good example of this. And I mean, this is my perspective, speaking as myself, as Jesse Valencia of Gorky. Not as of Music Portland, because this is what I experienced myself in the front lines of this, is that we didn't know anything like this about Prosper and all this information, or about what they've been doing in the Central East Side, or about TIFF when we went in there. When we went in there, we had organized, you know, with the people of Portland, thinking that we were going to go in there and show that with the majority of the city against this, that they would side with us and come to their senses and, you know, and vote in favor of our appeal. So, and for a little context of how that all happened at all, is that in 2018, Prosper bought those three lots in question that they're going to build the Live Nation venue on from ODOT for $2 million. And then they turned around. They were going to lease it to Beam Development, Jonathan Malzin, for 100 years to do a different type of property, though. It was going to be something completely different with, like, eateries and pedestrian walkways. And, like, it was going to be almost like a mall or a commerce center type thing. The pandemic happened, and that kind of went out the window, but they still had that deal in place. I don't know the process of this, but at some point it became a Live Nation venue, which is what then led to the BIPOC camp being cleared, which is what led to Music Portland's involvement.
Which is, I mean, it's just really upsetting when we know we have a housing issue and there's city property that was sold for developer that could totally make housing for people to afford. But instead, they are developing properties which increase the cost to live here.
Right.
And raise rents to unaffordable levels for the people who have made Portland is desirable to develop in and to be here, which it's the irony. They're killing what actually gives Portland life.
Exactly. And so when the election started to ramp up, I want to say in June, July, they pushed forward on the deal, and they were like, okay, we're going to break ground. Land use is approved. And so Music Portland went, what? We haven't heard about this. And so we went, wait a second. So we made an appeal. We had to raise money to get this appeal, right? Like $10,000 we had to get, or I can't remember what the actual number was, but we had to move fast because if we didn't do it by a certain day, we were going to miss our window.
You would have got steamrolled.
We would have got steamrolled, which is what ended up happening anyway. But we mobilized the people. We got the money we needed. We filed the appeal. We had a day of action at Lollipop Shop where all these news crews came, KGW, Coin. I was interviewed for them. Jamie Dunphy was interviewed. We did this. We popped off this whole thing, and like 100 people came. They broke the news story that night. Within 48 hours, there was a smear campaign against Jamie Dunphy and against Music Portland. And there was an important thing to keep in mind about this. Now, whatever your feelings are about what was said or what was done, you have to look at the Live Nation DOJ document on this, because if you go to specifically pages 34 through 36 of the DOJ complaint, it explains how Live Nation actually goes in and stops their competitors.
And I'm guessing that once we read those pages, is that 34 to 37?
Pages 34 to 36.
And 34 to 36. And if we were to read those, we could probably see some of those same actions and behaviors happening right now in Portland.
Absolutely. Because what Live Nation will do was they'll bully and intimidate, right? They'll bully and intimidate to confuse. Their goal isn't to be right. Mm-hmm. Their goal isn't to be correct about what they're saying. Their goal is to muddy the waters, so that they can then go in and say, yeah, hey, we've got a big market share, but look at AEG, who owns 20% to Live Nation 60, right? And they say AEG's financed by these awful people like we are. They're a multinational corporation. They try to do this apples to oranges thing. Going back real quick, because this is something that you were touching on earlier about Moda Center. There is a different venue being built or being planned in Lloyd Center in the old Nordstrom's by AEG and in accordance with Monkey Presents, right?
Right.
So, and people go apples to oranges with that. What's with the Monkey? They're doing that venue. What's up? It's not the venue that's the problem. It's the business model. It's Live Nation's business model.
It's their approach and their attitude.
Right. So we're going in to this situation. We have this appeal. The smear campaign happens. Within a week, on on social media, this thing explodes with this comment that Jamie had made, and people on LinkedIn who are affiliated with Prosper Portland, who are affiliated with Beam Development and Colas Construction. Andrew Colas is Jonathan Malzin's partner on the Live Nation venue, and coordinated with him and to do this smear campaign, because they put out this what would you call it, like a it wasn't really a press release, it was like a joint statement, basically comparing Music Portland to what we were saying at this event, this town hall, is being compared to inciting violence, like the Tulsa race massacre, or that we were a bunch of violent extremists, and that we needed to distance ourselves from JB Dunphy because he was trying to incite violent rhetoric against this venue. And then Colas had leveraged his, he's an African-American man, and this is all public because you could see it on Prosper's site and on the city council YouTubes. Like, if you go to YouTube and find these videos, they're on there. He leveraged his time during the Q&A sessions at Prosper and at the city council to leverage attacks against Jamie and trying to muddy the waters even further. Right. And it was successful. It worked because all of these people demanded apologies and the waters were muddied. Right. And guess what happened during that time leading up to the hearing? Now, granted, our appeal was granted. Right. We're going into this hearing now. Somehow or some way, I don't know how, Prosper changed the deal from a land lease to a direct land sale during that process, while everyone was confused behind closed doors. And they announced it the Monday of the week that we were doing the Live Nation hearing, right? It was like that Thursday. We were supposed to, our appeal was granted. We were going in to talk on Thursday to the city council. Wednesday, they scheduled the land sale hearing.
You know what? It sounds just like you were talking about that whole going in to distract people. So throw out a whole bunch of, ooh, look, shiny, fun objects for you to fight over and argue about. Well, just for you to be busy, because the real plan is just to keep you occupied so you won't notice my real maneuver.
Totally.
Behind closed doors to change things for a for-profit.
Totally.
That doesn't give back to the community that it's been taken from.
Isn't that how a magician like confuses you and gets away with his trick?
Correct.
You're looking.
That's
here,
exactly what happened.
That's exactly what it is. Okay. Yeah.
And this is why it's important to look at the materials on Prosper's website and the materials on the city council website. And I'm speaking as an indigenous person. Full disclosure: I recently enrolled in the Texas Band of Yaqui Indians after a 25-year fight to prove my ancestry,
which is its own thing. That, as you know, I'm not Native American, but it makes my insides curdle when I hear about this kind of struggle. So
I pointed it out.
Congratulations on being acknowledged for who you are.
Thank you. And I pointed this out at the hearings, and because you know they tried to bring up this thing, and I pointed out that what the developers were doing was in lockstep with what Live Nation does to their competitors. Only this time, the competitor isn't another venue or a ticketer. It's a public process.
It's the people.
And it's the people of Portland. So now you have Live Nation magnifying a smear campaign online. And then also Sam Cole, who is this man, Sam Cole, who is the stage manager for the Lumineers.
That's familiar.
Yeah, he came on during our online day of action with Music Portland, which was just, it was supposed to be our chance to inform the public of the Live Nation issue. He came on and didn't disclose that he worked for Live Nation and was presenting this apples to oranges argument. So if you look at the developers as being the ones who are using the intimidation tactics of, let's take this one thing that this person said and spin it out of context so that we can confuse the waters. Then we're going to have this side present the apples to oranges, AEG versus Live Nation argument. That's why I emphasize page 34 through 36 of the DOJ complaint. What happened to us in these Live Nation hearings is the same thing that Live Nation has done to to other cities, but with their competitors.
And I the reason I keep bringing up the attitude and approach is because it's not just a music industry. It's not just Live Nation. It's kind of what I personally refer to as like the corporatocracy.
Right.
It's the model that they have, and it's completely destructive. It's top down, and it doesn't leave any room for growth, creativity, or expression. It's all about control.
Right. And if you're paying attention to the news, which I know you guys are with the local stuff, you see the Live Nation venue, the development was one of a couple that are happening.
There's a lot of developments for one, but we haven't even mentioned like
Zydel Yards for MLB Stadium.
People are talking about the Keller Auditorium. When is that going to get redone? You know, we've talked about the Lloyd Center, which has been off and on constantly since it shut down as a mall. I am saddened that there is no ice rink anymore in town. That was a gem to go and ice skate at the mall.
Yeah.
And they had a movie theater, and it was a center of everything. You could park, you could visit things, visit businesses, have lunch.
Well,
and now it's an area that is
goes in, it'll be awesome.
It's awkward and difficult, and you know, it doesn't have an anchor, it doesn't have anything good going on. But if they were to make it into a giant corporate-based for-profit only venue rather than a creativity that happens to profit,
right,
It would completely change it into an area that would just be unaffordable to utilize. You're lucky if you could afford to go and watch one artist there a year because of all the associated costs outside of the ticket and the taxes,
right,
and the parking. You can't afford to eat in the area. Driving through, it's a nightmare. Something that used to take 15 minutes to cross through that area with lights, you know, all the stoplights, will now take 45 minutes or longer, and there's constant, you know, traffic jams and accidents, and it changes the nature of this space when you turn it into a big conglomerate controlled zone that wants to maximize profit, maximize people with the minimum expense, minimum staffing, minimum return back to the community, when they're going to spend millions to lobby against paying taxes or to spend $150,000 to fund a community organization. You know, they'd rather spend $2 million to fight that.
Yeah.
And that's the approach and mentality that comes in at this big monopoly level, the antitrust level, and comes in and takes over. And I would be very saddened, honestly, if they turned everything in the east side or west side downtown into major monopolistic corporate things. I don't think that would make Portland a destination to go and visit. It would not make Portland unique. It would take away everything unique in Portland.
Right.
If if you're going to have the same companies, the same artists, the same restaurants, the same lights, the same benches, the same tone, same parking spaces, same developers, same attitudes as New York, as Seattle, as LA, then why? Why would you go? I don't want to travel to a city to experience the same thing that I can get in other cities. The whole point is that there's supposed to be a unique fabric of culture and community in each space. So when you go there, you get a flavor of the human experience that has always lived there, you know, that has built it from the ground up. That is what a foundation is. It's from the ground up, not the top down. And I think that we don't want to develop the strongest parts of Portland out of it. You know what I mean? Go ahead, Corey.
Actually, I was just basically going to say we don't want a city's carbon copy of another same music industry within another one.
We don't want to copy another city. We don't want to just be like them and be a follower. We want Portland to be a leader. You don't need to be the first, the fastest, the most expensive, or the shiniest. You need to be authentic, and that means being there for the long run. That means supporting the artist through, you know, the four shows that didn't sell out and weren't huge, because they learned and grew and built and connected throughout all of those experiences. So when maybe it's their sixth or 10th that an artist really entrenches and finds their groove. And now all of a sudden that's an artist that's known nationally or internationally as having come from Portland, Oregon, because we let them grow and develop here individually and naturally, instead of telling them that you have these benchmarks and this much profit and this is what you're allowed to do and how many shows you're allowed to have. And we're going to control it all and do it for you, because someone who does it for you isn't helping you. They're actually keeping you down.
So off that.
Sorry,
point,
that was a lot.
Oh, no, it's good, because to your point, Jamie Dunphy, who's running for East Portland's District 1, has this awesome podcast he does called Stumptown Soundcheck, where we talk a lot about how the things we want to see Portland do to make sure that that continues. And that's why it's so important to look at the Live Nation development issue as you could look at it from the perspective of the music industry, the local music industry, and say, oh, this is going to kill venues. This is gonna be... You can also pull back a little bit broader and see the Live Nation venue development as an example of why Prosper Portland is bad for the city. And then
administrative issues and decision makers.
And then the next step that you go from there, and I mean, it's pretty clear to me. I mean, if we pass this new form of government, we have, you know, we're expanding the city council from 4 to 12, right? Those 12 councilors are not going to be commissioners anymore. So they're not going to oversee departments that they're not qualified to run. The mayor is going to have a city manager now. So yeah, like all of that is good, but we're 2/3 of the way there to this, to fixing or to setting ourselves up for a government that's going to succeed and for Portland.
It's important that we actually are able to finish it rather than allowing these large money sources, these, you know, international and non-local, you know, voices to come in and actually take those seats and steer all the progress that we've made into another direction.
Right.
Because I feel that that is what has happened when we're at the point that we're at now. We've made these great changes. We're making progress.
It's easy to
do. And we're right at that point where all they have to do is, you know, have someone slip in and join with, you know, all the right buzzwords.
Yeah.
And then once they're in that spot, they're actually doing lip service to us, but giving real service to the development and the companies that we were intending to, you know, scoot out of the picture where they belong, on the sidelines instead of in the control seat.
Right. Well, I mean, just imagine this, because Portland Development Commission, aka Prosper Portland, still exists like it did. So the council has changed, the mayor has changed. But the Prosper has not changed.
But if you look at policy and its objectives from when it was created in the 1950s,
yeah,
its goal is still exactly the same. So that's a 1950s mentality.
I mean, when we were explaining about TIF districts, the thing is, like, the debts that accrue from that, they'll be paid off for 30 or 50 years. So the reason why you're seeing, you know, homelessness and everything getting worse now is from decisions that were made 20, 30 years ago.
Correct.
The thing is this, it's simple. It's not as simple as going, we're going to end Prosper Portland. Let's pass something that ends Prosper Portland. That's not what it is.
The policies that will be affecting the area in the next decade or two.
Yeah, but to get there, what you have to do is a really simple fix, I see. It's just to take development out of the hands of Prosper and put it in the hands of the city council. So the thing is that with the city council expanded to 12, you know, with there was 5 commissioners on Prosper before and 4 for the city, now you have a city council that has 12 that could do everything. So if you're talking about development, put it in the hands of the city, put it in the hands of the people we're electing so that they can make subcommittees, so that those subcommittees will be beholden to the people and their votes
and
if they make a wrong decision.
And public record. So then if you would like to know what they're doing, if the city council's handling it, it's a lot easier to make that FOIA request and track down the records and the organizational management rather than, you know, semi-private, basically, firm that's contracted by the city. Because once they're a third-party contract, the city is not in charge. It's that company.
Right.
Right? It's that council. It's that organization that now has the power. And that changes whether or not you can get any information on what they do.
Right.
And the decisions they make, whether you have any say whatsoever. And if the city is paying that company, organization, whatever it is, millions of dollars.
Right.
I really think that it's important for Portland residents to be able to know what is happening with those millions of dollars that keep being given to this organization.
Right.
So we've covered a lot here.
Yeah.
Where can people find out more information on this? Where can people find you? Just basically self-plug here.
People can find me at GorkyPDX, which is my Instagram. That's usually where I'm most active. It's GORKY_PDX. And then my website's GorkMania.com. Okay. If you want to learn more about Music Portland, go to MusicPortland.org or follow us on Instagram. Plug also for my friend Jamie Dunphy, who is running for East Portland's District 1. He's been the leader in this fight, and he's taken a lot of hits, and he's been a champion. Willamette Weekly just ranked him number one choice because he's been right about the Live Nation venue, and they mentioned that. So I want to lean into that and say, if you are in East Portland and you are a musician or you're concerned about the future of this city, rank Jamie Dunphy number one so that we can keep working on that.
Lastly, is there anything happening in like November or maybe even December that's big that you want people to maybe put on their calendars or put on their radar now? Any decisions, any meetings, any events, other than, of course, the election?
Nothing right now. Music Portland has an events page, and I'll be at those a lot of our first Mondays if anyone wants to catch me and engage me on this. I also want to be clear that I'm not here to demonize anybody. Mm-hmm. The thing is that, you know, these developers and these businesses, these people, they're just like anybody else. They're trying to make money. Mm-hmm. They're working within a system, right, that is set up the way it is, and you can't blame them for that. So with us, what our job is as the people of Portland is to decide how do we want the future of this city to go with regards to its development. Do we want to develop it with homelessness in mind, with social housing in mind, with infrastructure improvements? If we want those things, then we need to change development from Prosper back to the city council. Mm-hmm. We can do it. We had PDC, a.k.a. Prosper, since 1958. It's done a lot of good. It's done a lot of bad. It's time to reassess it. We should audit it. We should look at how... We should look at reforming it. We should look at bringing those mechanics into the city and moving forward. So
I agree. Any policy that's half a century old, it's just genuinely time to look at it with the new updated eyes of social learning and progress, you know, and see, is this still working? Does it still align with the goals now and who we are now in this millennia?
Yeah, so, totally. And then next year, I'm probably going to have my head deep in music policy still, but I'm hoping to play more shows as Gorky. So hopefully you'll have a lot more fun going on next year and not so much, you know, large sweeping historical fights.
That was the last thing I was going to ask before we sign off and say goodbye, was that your band Gorky, are we going to see them in town? Where should we?
Totally. I have to get a new lineup together, but stay tuned on that because I am raring and ready to rip on stage here.
Well, as you know, Portland loves music, independent artists. So welcome.
Thank you.
Looking forward to it.
And thank you for talking with us.
Absolutely. And I'd love to be back.
And thank you for listening, folks at home. You've been listening to Trippy.
This has been Trippy on KBOO Portland Community Radio.
I'm not going to let the generation that comes after me be dumb, deaf, and blind.
KBOO Portland.